طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that it is broadcast each week on This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts. Today we take another look at the influence of the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, APAC, on American elections and their role to squash any vestige of criticism of Israel. It's largely their role in pouring literally millions of dollars into political campaigns that creates enormous influence on candidates running for office. The message is clear. If you want our money and support, do not cross Israel. In this broadcast, journalist and Foundation for Middle East Peace Fellow Peter Beinart speaks with Waleed Shahid, spokesperson and communications director of Justice Democrats. Waleed Shahid is a spokesperson and communications director for Justice Democrats, the grassroots progressive organization that recruited and helped elect Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Cori Bush, and Jamal Bowman, as well as congressional candidate Summer Lee, and launched the campaign for a Green New Deal. He's a member of the nation's editorial board. Peter Beinart teaches national reporting and opinion writing at the Newmark J. School and political science at CUNY University Graduate Center. He is editor-at-large for Jewish Currents and is an MSNBC political commentator and a fellow at the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Here are Peter Beinart and Waleed Shahid speaking on the podcast Occupied Thoughts.
Hello and welcome to Occupied Thoughts, a podcast brought to you by the Foundation for Middle East Peace. I'm Peter Beinart, non-resident fellow at the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Today is June 3rd, 2022, and I'm delighted to be here with Waleed Shahid. Waleed is the spokesperson and communications director for Justice Democrats, the grassroots progressive organization that recruited and helped elect Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Cori Bush, and Jamal Bowman, as well as congressional candidate Summer Lee, and launched the campaign for a Green New Deal. And the reason that I was particularly keen to talk to you today, Waleed, is that it's become, I think, increasingly clear in recent weeks that something about the political dynamic, the terms of the electoral fight between AIPAC and its allies and progressive folks who support Palestinian rights has changed as a result of new institutions that have been created on the kind of AIPAC side that have been able to dump huge amounts of money into races against candidates who are sympathetic to Palestinian rights. So I would love to start by you talking a little bit about what you think has changed.
Yeah, I think to start from the beginning, this all really begins with the 2016 candidacy of Bernie Sanders for president, which revealed that there was about 40% of the Democratic Party electorate that wanted a Bernie Sanders style social democratic socialist politics. And in the House of Representatives, in the Senate, that was not the case. 40% of Democrats in Washington were not representative of Bernie Sanders' views about economic or social policy. And so a major piece of that was Bernie Sanders' foreign policy views with respect to not just Israel-Palestine, but also his views on Saudi Arabia, his views on Iran, his views on not Latin America. And you've seen that ideological framework that Bernie Sanders had be expanded and continue to be run through organizations like ours, and then candidates like AOC, Ayanna Pressley, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and then in 2020 with Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush and Jessica Cisneros to Summer Lee, which was the election just happened a month ago. And so I say all that just to say that, like, to start there, because in 2016, 2018 with Bernie and AOC, like, and even Ilhan and Rashida and Ayanna Pressley, the establishment forces in Washington were kind of caught off guard by those two, 2016 and 2018. And then in 2020, with Jamal Bowman's candidacy, was the first time where we saw major spending and major organizing by the foreign policy establishment, particularly by the Democratic majority for Israel. In 2020, AIPAC did not have a super PAC. Now they do. Similar to the way the Justice Democrats expanded after AOC's victory, it was really Elliot Engel's loss that I think catalyzed Democratic majority for Israel to grow and get more aggressive and invest early. And then for AIPAC to launch its own super PAC that's even bigger than the DMFI. And then there's a lot of affiliated groups that have different names that are also adjacent to foreign policy goals of AIPAC and DMFI that have spent a lot against Jessica Cisneros and Summer Lee, who are two progressive candidates that we recruited. So there's been, you know, in both the Summer Lee race and the Jessica Cisneros race, AIPAC was essentially the number one spender in those races. Races that never had a public debate about Israel-Palestine at all. There was no, very little discussion, public discussion that voters could access that was about Israel-Palestine. Because, you know, the kinds of, these groups know that many voters don't care about Israel-Palestine. And so they spend lots of money on ads that basically just attack the candidate's biggest vulnerabilities, even if they have no respect to, no relationship to their foreign policy goals. I'll stop there, and I don't know, Peter. Maybe you can ask me another question, but I just wanted to give like the large, from 2016 to now, like how we've ended up here. But I do think they are responding to the left kind of going on the offense post 2016, and now they were kind of in like Star Wars Episode 5, where the Empire Strikes Back, so to speak. It has been a difficult year.
So let's talk about how this has played out in certain different races and what kind of lessons one can learn from it. So you mentioned Summer Lee. This is a case where despite her being and her supporters being outspent, I think, by a significant margin, she was actually able to win a narrow victory over a more moderate candidate who kind of shared AIPAC's views on Israel-Palestine. What are the lessons that you think you can draw from her victory?
Well, so Summer Lee was a sitting state representative representing the areas of Braddock and Pittsburgh. People might know Braddock as also being the town that John Fetterman is from. Deindustrialized, high poverty town, extremely diverse town, home to one of the largest steel mills on the East Coast, or I guess it's not the East Coast, but on the Eastern United States. And then I think she has really made a name for herself in that community as a progressive Democratic fighter. You know, AIPAC and DMFI's case against Summer Lee was that she was not an authentic Democrat. She was actually a Republican, and she was a Republican because she opposed Joe Biden in the primary and said some critical things of Joe Biden in the primary. You know, if we took that as our standard bearer of what makes you Republican, then Kamala Harris would be a Republican because she had the most, one of the most aggressive statements against Joe Biden in the debates, as we all remember, about school segregation. And so I think the candidate really matters, someone who can really voters can trust. And so people knew Summer Lee as their Democratic state representative. So the ads that AIPAC was running against her didn't land as fully as they might have with a candidate that maybe had a little bit less of a record that people didn't know as much. And honestly, like most of our candidates are not like Summerlee. Like Jamal Bowman had no political experience whatsoever. He was a principal. And so that went well for us with Summerlee. And then the second thing was, you know, Justice Democrats also had an independent expenditure where we were able to go on offense against Apex candidate Steve Irwin. Steve Irwin is someone who has literally donated money to Pat Toomey, the Republican senator of Pennsylvania. And so we thought, we obviously didn't have as much money as AIPAC or DMFI did, but our independent arm's ability to make a case against Steve Irwin on the same basis that they were making against Summerlee with even stronger evidence — Summerlee has never donated to a Republican — also went really far. But, you know, the race with Steve Irwin, you know, in their own internal numbers, went up 25 points in the polls after AIPAC made their TV advertisements against Summerlee. And so, you know, with it shows how effective these advertisements can be, that it can convince many lower information voters that their sitting Democratic representative, who, you know, attended a Joe Biden rally in October of 2020 and spoke at it, is a Republican. Like, these TV ads can go a long way. So you need to have a candidate who can be an authentic messenger who people can trust. And then also you have to go on offense against their attacks, the candidate themselves and the independent groups like ours who are able to go on air and do mailers about how.
And did Summerlee have a record of support for Palestinian rights? I mean, what was AIPAC so worried about? Or was it more just that she seemed like she was progressive in general and they felt like that somehow the vibe of the squad would kind of, you know, wash over her?
You know, Summerlee had one tweet during the Sheikh Jarrah incidents that were happening where she said something like, as a Black woman, I understand what it feels like to be, feel like you're occupied or something. And and so that was the tweet that was being circulated by in Jewish press and Israeli press about Summerlee. There was actually a Jewish local newspaper in Pittsburgh that used that tweet to then use that tweet as a source for Summerlee's basically like accusing her of anti-Semitism through that tweet. So that was what they were going off of. But, you know, Jessica Cisneros has, from what I know of, no public statements about Israel-Palestine whatsoever.
She's the candidate in San Antonio and Texas, who's running, whose primary was just last week, right?
Yeah, she is running. This is still the election happened, but the votes still haven't been called by official observers. But she's running against an anti-choice, pro-NRA Democrat, Henry Cuellar. And AIPAC was one of the number one spenders in that race against Jessica Cisneros. But Cisneros, to my knowledge, has zero public statements about Israel-Palestine. She was endorsed by J Street, and she was endorsed by Justice Democrats. And so I think through the basis of that, AIPAC determined, and one of AIPAC's affiliates, Mainstream Democrats PAC, determined that she was not sufficiently loyal to the Israeli government's line or whatever their ideological line is. And so, yeah, that was all. That was between those two candidates. That's basically all the public information we have about them. But I think they understand the way that, you know, they're taking the same kinds of the same kind of political theory that we had in 2016, 2018, which is like, if there are certain ideological policy elements that you care about in a political party, you know, and for Justice Democrats, climate change and healthcare were our number one and number two priorities, that the battle to effectively move a party on that issue is in these primaries. And so I think AIPAC and DMFI have determined, come to the same conclusion, that in order to discipline and punish the party for straying too much from a right-wing view of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict into the occupation, they have to discipline and punish through their involvement in primaries. And I can say it has been effective for them.
So I wanted to ask you about another race a little bit earlier on, or two races in the same district between the same candidates in Cleveland, between Chantel Brown and Nina Turner. This was a case where the AIPAC supported candidate won. And I wonder what lessons you take from that, you know, that less happy outcome.
You know, we backed Justice Democrats backed Nina Turner in her first race. We did not we were not involved in the second race. You know, I think Nina Turner had very explicit comments about Joe Biden that just were not true of Summer Lee. And her opposition was much more verbalized. And I think that, you know, if looking back on it, I think the case against Nina Turner was that she was also a Republican and not a loyal Biden Democrat. I think Nina Turner could have done a much better job, like, calling herself a Democrat. Mm-hmm. I think her first ad that she put out didn't mention that she was a Democrat, which I thought was a bit of an unforced error. There was also an element of people thinking too much that she was a Bernie candidate. And mm-hmm. I think that can narrow you a bit when you have to win usually over 50% of a primary. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Bernie won over 50% of that district in his presidential runs. And, you know, like a lot of candidacies have done more explicitly Jewish outreach. So mm-hmm. Summer Lee had many people involved in Jewish institutions who were organizing on her behalf, and Jamal Bowman did. Jessica Cisneros doesn't have a very high Jewish population in her district, from what I'm aware of. But, you know, I read in Jewish Currents that Nina Turner did not have a Jewish outreach program. And I think some of that stuff is helpful for dealing with mm-hmm. disinformation and misinformation that people are hearing about candidates. So, yeah, so those are some things that people could learn from that. J Street did not endorse Nina Turner in that race, which is also a little different from, you know, J Street did endorse Summer Lee and Jessica Cisneros. So there are, in terms of groups that care about the occupation and wanting to end it, you know, I would encourage them to see where the winds are blowing in some of these primaries and get involved as much as they can.
Do you, I'm curious, you mentioned earlier that Summer Lee is from represents the same town that the Pennsylvania Senate candidate John Fetterman is from. It seems like in the Senate races, we haven't even really gotten to the stage where you have candidates who have a progressive enough view on Israel-Palestine that they're even worth backing, or for that matter, worth quashing. Am I, Fetterman doesn't seem like he's taken a progressive position on this, even though he's considered to be a fairly progressive guy in other ways. Is that right? And if so, why the difference between the city Senate and House races?
I think that's right. I mean, this is a tricky topic to talk about because it is ultimately a lot to do with money. And I think these Senate races are so expensive that effective and pragmatic Senate candidates like Fetterman want to do whatever they can to win. So why, and this is the success of AIPAC and DMFI, why alienate or why provoke these super PACs from getting involved against you when you can, quote, take the easy way out and say, you know, which is what Fetterman did, I am pro-Israel and I've always been pro-Israel, which doesn't say anything really, but it says enough to send the signals to the right groups that you're not an adversary. And so because these races are so expensive, people are really worried and so competitive. People are really worried about provoking special interest groups from getting involved in these races. You know, that just Chris Murphy seems to have the same views as Andy Levin on Israel-Palestine. Maybe people think he's too safe to be primaried or something. Again, like primarying a Senate candidate is extremely difficult because of the spending required to reach that many voters. But I think you're right that this has not reached the Senate level.
So you must talk to candidates a lot, and I'm sure you have these conversations all the time. What do you say to someone who says, look, Waleed, you know, I just need to get in there into Congress so I can work on healthcare and climate change and saving America from the Republican assault on democracy. And this issue just is not important enough to me and my voters to be willing to basically potentially torpedo my chances. So I'm going to I'm going to cave on that issue as a practical, pragmatic decision. How do you convince the person not to?
That's a good question. I mean, your previous question and this one just made me also think about Raphael Warnock, who had made comments Israel-Palestine from his own, Black egalitarian, theological tradition.
And
a trippy that he took there and then basically had to retract his statements.
Yes, I didn't really see all those things that I actually described when I was there. Right.
Yeah, I was really sad to see that, 1 or 2 months before his election. But yeah, I think, a lot of the candidates I work with have very little experience or relationship to this issue, other than they know it's a thorny issue in which if they say the wrong thing, something bad will happen to them. You know, I do try to get them to meet with as many experts on the issue as possible, ask all the questions they have, you know, in spaces that feel private and safe for them to do so. People send them readings and briefings. I do think there's an element, especially because of DMFI and APEC, that people are like, why don't I just say the easy thing, which is to satisfy these groups from not spending against me. And, you know, it is not in the self-interest, the like pragmatic self-interest of our candidates or Justice Democrats as an organization to encourage other groups to spend against our candidates from a purely self-interested perspective. But from a moral and ideological and like spiritual perspective, I do try to encourage our candidates to draw linkages between their domestic social justice values. And, you know, some of our candidates are religious, from their religious social justice values to foreign policy, whether that's Israel-Palestine or Latin America or, you know, the Saudi-led war in Yemen. And to say like, well, why would you say it is not true to your values to just take a stance for political purposes and self-interested purposes. And that's not the kinds of candidates we're interested in supporting. Because once you do that on one issue, you're going to do that on every other issue, whether it's climate or healthcare or what private prisons or whatever. Yeah, I think, you know, they're hard conversations. I think always I encourage them to talk to Jews and Palestinians in their districts also, just to know the sense of where people are at in their districts and to talk to people who disagree with them. Like the number one thing is I don't want a candidate to do is be shocked when someone disagrees with them about, you know, a kind of progressive perspective about foreign policy. So those are some of the things, but yeah, it is difficult.
Oftentimes the way these things are framed in terms of the politics is kind of, you know, you've got APAC from the kind of right wing of the American Jewish community coming in and having a big impact, and then maybe a lesser impact of kind of J Street on the more progressive side of the American Jewish community. But I'm curious about how significant, you know, there are other groups of Americans who have equities and particular concerns in this issue in different ways. Obviously, Palestinian Americans and in different ways, Arab Americans, Muslim Americans might have a particular interest. Do you, and these, you know, to make a sweeping generalization, tend to often be more immigrant communities. Do you feel like those communities are starting to have a political impact on this issue? What signs do you see and what might be the obstacles to that?
I think there's a burgeoning but small network of Palestinian and Arab Americans who Israel-Palestine is their number one issue and are seeing that, you know, if you stick your neck out a little bit on this issue for Palestinian rights and even just an even-handed approach, which Andy Levin has, $1 to $6 million against you. And so
people who are not, Andy Levin is a Democratic congressman in Michigan running in a runoff against another Democratic congressman. The APAC is supporting his opponent because he supports this kind of two-state bill, and J Street is supporting him. So anyway, just as background.
So, but yeah, I would say it's still very small and, you know, and it's in a fledgling state there. My limited experience talking to Palestinian operatives and donors is that they really never felt like there was a space for them in the Democratic Party or in congressional politics. And that has started to change since 2018 with the election of Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and AOC. And yeah, and Palestinian donors and our organizations want to support Palestinian candidates, you know, from a representative place, but also from a trust place. They've experienced so many times that, you know, betray them and betray their cause and are really traumatized from those experiences. And so think electoral politics is a place where either the movement is not ready or it's a place of ultimately where betrayal happens and there's no space for it. So like kinds of more 501c3 educational efforts might be a safer place and a more pure place to put your money and resources. But I think it's starting to grow. I will say for the vast majority of our supporters, our donors and volunteers, Israel-Palestine is really not their number one, number two, or number three concern. It's usually things like healthcare, racial justice, or climate change, I would say. But Yeah, I am optimistic that whether it's groups like J Street or whether it's more Palestinian-led organizations, that people will start to see primaries as the battleground for where the soul of the Democratic Party will go on foreign policy with respect to Israel-Palestine, as it has on so many other issues.
Right. I mean, one of the things that I noticed came up a fair amount in the Summer Lee race was, you know, charges that AIPAC was, you know, attacking a progressive Black woman. Her opponent, Steve Irwin, was a white guy. It seems like in a certain kind of way, AIPAC and its supporters are trying to flip that script in the Rashida Tlaib race, where they're one of the things that this new group that Bakari Sellers has started has been saying as well. It's bad that Detroit doesn't have any Black members of Congress representing it. And the implication that somehow, you know, Rashida Tlaib's, because she's Palestinian, she's distracted by these issues far away and she's not focusing on the things in her district. And I just wonder, I'll just put my cards on the table. I was worried about the framing in the Summer Lee race that basically what was wrong was that AIPAC was attacking a Black woman, because it just seemed to me that AIPAC was smart enough to be able to play this game and to find people who, you know, they could find people, candidates of color, they have been able to, and the real issue is this, that they're opposed to candidates irrespective of their race, religion, or ethnicity who support Palestinian rights. But how do you think in the Rashida Tlaib race, what do you think the right way for folks to respond is to that kind of that argument about racial representation?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I mean, Chantal Brown was also a Black woman who DMFIs in a, I think AIPAC also supported. I don't know if their super PAC was around by her second campaign. But yeah, I think, look, the Bakari Sellers adjacent super PAC that is also AIPAC adjacent and Wall Street adjacent, if you count their number one donor being from that background. I think that, you know, one of the sad things about that kinds of argument is that nobody wins. Like, that district that Rashida is running in is, I think, the most Palestinian district in the United States. Mm-hmm. and definitely one of the most Arab districts in the United States. And so to say that she has no right to represent that community in Congress and this other marginalized community does, it just is an argument where everyone suffers, I think. The thing that I will say is that, like, obviously AIPAC and DMFI's singular primary focus is to discipline and punish the party around the lines of Israel-Palestine. But it's not that far off to say that they're also aligned with generally the more moderate wing of the party overall speaking, right, on the other host of issues. Mark Mellman, for instance, sits on the board of an organization that does not support Black Lives Matter and the Movement for Black Lives policing policies. And, you know, has frequently written columns about the party moving too far to the left, not on Israel-Palestine, but on climate, immigration, other issues. And so, I think that I'm not sure that that argument is the primary one to make, but it's also difficult because what the press tends to, if Rashida or Summer Lee or Jessica Cisneros says the reason they're spending against me is because they want to make sure that every candidate running for office is afraid of speaking up for human rights everywhere. The way the press covers that is that Jessica Cisneros or Rashida Tlaib is obsessed with Israel. or is singling out Israel. Yeah. So it's hard. It's a tricky situation.
So the last question I want to ask you, which is a little more personal, is that you found yourself in the midst of a bit of a firestorm. A couple weeks ago, when Anti-Defamation League, the head of the Anti-Defamation League, Jonathan Greenblatt, singled out a tweet, a joke that you had made about this Jewish publication, Jewish Insider, where you had joked that you had kind of played off it and used the word goy outsider. And then Jonathan Greenblatt, who's been on this tear about the idea that, you know, people who are anti-Zionists are the equivalent of white nationalists, kind of singled you out as evidence of this. And I'm just interested in, I was glad to see that a lot of people came to your defense and kind of challenged him about this. But I'm just curious what it was like to be in the middle of that. I mean, in the sense that if part of what's happens in these dynamics is that candidates, and not just candidates, other people in public life kind of, you know, are get intimidated by threats of being called, you know, names that no one wants to be called, or at least nobody decent wants to be called. I just wondered, interesting what that was, the experience was like for you and what lessons you would draw from it.
Yeah, I mean, the days after that were quite an experience for me. I think originally I just thought it was funny. I was just like, this is ridiculous. Like, are you serious right now? I also didn't understand even the connection he was drawing between what I had said as a joke and the association of that with the far right. And like the thing I tweeted, I did check in with like a couple of Jewish colleagues and friends of mine. I was like, do you think this is anti-Semitic? And they all said the same thing, which was, it's not anti-Semitic, but your joke isn't that funny either, which I thought was like a perfectly Jewish response to a non-Jew asking if their joke was anti-Semitic. it also just made me sad because there was no way to, I felt very powerless about it. I felt very much like, you know, I didn't want to say something that made it seem like, well, some of my best friends are Jewish.
Right.
And like, right. And I was like, I don't really know what to say to this. The truth. And then there's a political truth that like the publication I was making fun of is an outlet that often is a mouthpiece for DMFI and APEC.
Yes,
and, and the story that they were running that I was making fun of was about how APEC's candidate actually was successful in a race he lost, and they buried the lead that Summer Lee defeated the APEC candidate. And I just wanted to point out in an unartful way that was just funny to me. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I had a CNN anchor reach out to me and DM me and like say really nasty things to me. You all maybe can guess which anchor that was. I won't say the name, but it was really hard. And just the sense of powerlessness that I felt, because I'm like, there's no place of recourse I can have to have Jonathan Greenblatt here my side. And then there was no place of recourse or justice or conversation even about this. And then when the ADL made their second comment that the reason Jonathan Greenblatt, you know, the CEO of the largest Jewish civil rights organization in the United States, the reason he decided to say that what I was doing was anti-Semitic was because my organization and I single out Israel when the, you know, some of the largest spenders against the candidates I'm running against, I'm sorry, some of the largest spenders against the candidates I work for are groups that single out Israel for not having any, not being beholden to any of our values as Americans around foreign policy. So it was quite a whirlwind. You know, some of the candidates I work for also reached out to me in a humorous way where they were like, you've been trying to help me not get canceled for my views. And now look, you're the one who is getting ridiculed by the head of the largest Jewish civil rights organization. So I don't know. I mean, it was really beautiful to see so many Jewish leaders speak out on my behalf very immediately after, and I felt very touched by that. I don't really know what to say about it other than that.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed to me there's such a deep irony here, and that this is such a perfect illustration of the kind of dynamics of cancel culture. You know, that when it plays out on other issues, you know, people getting called racist or homophobic or sexist or whatever, you have all these people on the right, you know, including big supporters of Israel who feel like this is the end of the world that this kind of thing happens, because they can so identify with the idea that they may get called racist unfairly and that they would feel kind of powerless and they wouldn't know where to get their reputation. And yet it just drives me crazy that some of the same people do that so promiscuously on this issue, and that there's no accountability. I mean, you know, that people should have to think twice, three times before lobbying charges that have really powerful effects on people's lives. They should really have to do their homework. They should reach out to those people. They should really be careful. They should have a kind of reverence for the power and the importance of a charge like anti-Semitism, because you're essentially trading on the moral power of, you know, the history of Jewish suffering. And yet, you know, and yet the way people like Jonathan Greenblatt use this phrase, it seems to me so much a kind of desecration of that. So anyway, it drives me crazy, but I'm very glad to see that, you know, you kind of come through it. And I also think that perhaps people who share your values, irrespective of whether they're Jewish or not, maybe are better organized and more, you know, better organized around these issues, better able to respond than maybe we would have been a few years ago. And I think that's a positive development.
Yeah. I think the last thing I'll say about it is just also to equate not just me, but, you know, this is Greenblatt's kind of ideological point of view, to equate the progressive movement writ large with the Buffalo shooter is just really sad. And really, it's kind of like where this thing happens where every nail needs a hammer. And so like every progressive needs to be hammered with this thing in order for there to be a both sides equivalent that Trump and then the Buffalo shooter and then Justice Democrats are all equal in terms of our problems with anti-Semitism. When, you know, when Greenblatt did make his statements apologizing for his organization's role in being part of the efforts to stop the so-called Ground Zero Mosque from being constructed, I thought that was a step forward and a way of extending an arm across the aisle and in the Trump era to like really forge bonds of solidarity against Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, and white supremacy. And then for him to, in the week of the Buffalo shooting, just choose me as his target, it's just really, yeah, disheartening. And like, there's no accountability for him to really reckon with how wrong that is.
Yes, right. No, and I think the point you're implying is just, I'll say it openly, which is that I think it's, you know, it's not coincidental that you, as a, you know, as an American Muslim, you know, were attacked this way. I think whether consciously and subconsciously, I mean, I think if you just look at the disparity between the way people talk about Ilhan Omar or Rishi Tlaib on the one hand or Betty McCollum on the other, there's a way in whether people are willing to admit this to themselves or not, that this kind of discourse lands especially heavily on American Muslims in a way that I think is just, you know, the grounds that fuels very, very dangerous forms of bigotry that the ADL of all organizations should recognize it shouldn't be complicit in. I don't want to take any more of your time. Waleed, thank you for,
thanks for having me.
You have been listening to Peter Beinart and Waleed Shaheed discuss the political influence of AIPAC on the Occupied Thoughts podcast. Before we go, I want to play excerpts of a conversation I picked up on YouTube between Mondo Weiss's Phil Weiss and Boston peace activist Jeff Klein discussing the shifting opinions and analysis within the Jewish Committee concerning the role of Zionism in the Israeli colonial experience. It begins with a question from Jeff Klein to Phil Weiss.
I wonder if you could comment. I have some thoughts about this issue of the evangelicals in the United States, but I wonder if you could comment from your point of view how that trajectory has developed and is developing in the future.
Well, Jeff, first I have a question, though, about what you said. And it's a great, you posed it in a perfect way. But I'm curious, if Israel does become politicized fully in the manner in which you've described, and it's the Republican Party that is its protector in the United States, and it loses the Democratic Party, what do you think that would mean for Israel? Wouldn't that be, I should think that would be extremely worrying to Israel.
I think it is, but, they have to make some choices in terms of their allies and, what's available and what's not available. And as liberal opinion becomes more skeptical, you know, they're relying more and more on the sort of fortress right wing, you know, not just in the United States, but around the world also. And I guess I would say, you know, whatever the sort of liberal pretensions of Zionism was earlier, of course, they were self-described socialists that were, you know, some of the founders of Israel. The logic of an ethnic exclusive colonial state, which is, you know, indisputably what Israel is,
yes,
was, is not liberal.
No.
And And, you know, it's becoming clear to Israeli politicians that at least the right wing, which is very dominant in Israel, that, you know, in this age, to be a racialized, you know, ethnic state, you know, implies that you have to have different kinds of allies than the ones you had when you were supposedly building a kibbutz utopia in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was predictable, if anyone really thought about it. Not most of us did not, but it's logical that that was the development.
Yes.
You can't be a liberal colonialist.
On those kibbutzes, you know, they didn't allow Palestinians, you know, right there, including in places where, you know, they were on Palestinian land, you know. So a lot of this was baked in, or it was in the DNA or the seeds of this.
Yeah, without a doubt, without a doubt. And of course, you know, back, you know, before the creation of the State of Israel, people could be more explicit about it. It was common to use the terminology of colonialism in creating the pre-state Israel and the, you know, the sort of Zionist integration. No one thought that was, you know, that's become a little bit sort of disfavored and, you know, in the current environment. But people were very explicit about it, that this was a colonial enterprise. I mean, the Jewish National Fund, the predecessor of it was the Jewish Colonial Fund. And Herzl talked about that and so on. So you know, essentially the chickens are coming home to roost, colonial enterprise, and they're looking for the logical allies for that. And it's not progressive and liberal thought, even though there's a kind of hangover, right, of support and fondness for Israel that is constantly being undermined by the reality of it.
Yeah.
It's becoming harder and harder. The support.
Although I'd say that, you know, to answer your question about the time frame, and you would have some insight into this as much as I think I do, but certainly there was an anachronistic element to Zionism, certainly in the 40s, 50s. You know, we were supposed to be decolonizing the world, and here you were creating a colonial entity of some sort. One of the amazing, interesting things about American political history is that again and again, Black radicals raised this question in the American discourse. And so the SNCC Brain Trust in the 60s was raising this issue. And I think that, I mean, I don't have the facts right at hand, but Michael Fishbach goes into this in his book about the issue, a recent book, where, you know, SNCC would say, what about the Palestine question? These people are as oppressed as we are. And they lost their funding. You know, they had big Jewish funders who were very radical. They had radical Jewish friends, left-wing Jewish friends, who were left-wing up to this point, but they were not, they weren't questioning Zionism. I bring this up more to go to the timeline, which is that again and again, when the issue has been raised in the Democratic Party, it has been successfully repressed. And so I think that for all of us, one of the miracles of the last year is that this business, that this urgent question of oppression of based on race, Zionism is racism, the famous UN General Assembly a resolution of 1975. This has been an urgent question on the left, but it's always been pushed down by elites and by the party leadership in the Democratic Party, and indeed by broad sections of the Democratic Party, which could not tolerate this discourse. And the miracle is that it's finally coming in. So your question to me is, why is it that when this issue has never been politicized in any real way in America, America gives all this money and will never question its support for Israel. We all presidents stand by Israel, our best friend, as Biden put it. Why is it suddenly becoming politicized? And I guess everyone on this call, I think, and hopefully we'll be getting some of the participants, other participants will be unmuted before too long, will have their own theory about what has happened. But the two things I would point to are, one, Black Lives Matter, and the revolution that we are seeing in American political culture, maybe brought on by Trump, but where the progressive voices are really at the center of the democratic discourse. And that includes Black Lives Matter, and is a very urgent matter. And you cannot square the oppression of Palestinians under apartheid with the Black supporting Black Lives Matter. It's impossible to reconcile. And so even politicians, I think, like Chuck Schumer, who's up for re-election next year, is afraid of getting primaried by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or some other progressive young person. And he's being careful on this issue because this issue could really bite him. The other factor I would point to, and maybe this is, I know that I could be accused of some narcissism here, but hey, it's my point of view, is that the Jewish community has grown and matured, and that there has been an active anti-Zionist discussion inside the American Jewish community. And I feel that that has, and here I even credit J Street, an organization I don't really like, but J Street has helped to politicize the question. Has said there's more diversity in the Jewish community than just lockstep with Israel. And you have really important anti-Zionist group, Jewish Voice for Peace. You have a non-Zionist but renegade young Jewish group, If Not Now, which is challenging the leadership. So I think that that signal that the Jewish community is beginning to fracture is allowing other people to open their mouths. So those are the two factors I point to.
I definitely agree. And just in response to sort of your general wondering, why didn't this view take root sooner, about Israel and its colonial nature? I mean, really, you explained a lot of it at the very beginning, that, the question of anti-Semitism in Europe and the United States, the Holocaust, the tremendous guilt that at least liberal-minded people felt about, allowing that to happen or failing to stop it, gave a kind of Jewish exceptionalism to their colonial enterprise. In other words, it's absolutely true what Tony Judt and others have said was, starting a colonial enterprise after the Second World War, when decolonization was the main trend in the world, it was obsolete. Well, it was given a kind of exceptional pass because of the guilty conscience of a lot of the world about treating the Jews. And, frankly, people looked at the Jews as anti-Semitism was weakening, this sort of personal anti-Semitism, looked at the Jewish founders of Israel, and they were people who looked like us. And the Arabs were this other that we still, in the colonial mindset, didn't count very much. Ben-Gurion and the early founders of Israel could tour the United States and, hey, we're Europeans, we're civilized, and we're fighting for a country among these uncivilized Muslim Arabs. And, that carried a lot of weight, particularly with that guilt of the, the experience of the Jews. And it's taken a generation or two for that exceptionalism to wear off and for people to take the blinders off and see this colonial enterprise for what it is. In the same way, people had no trouble understanding what South African apartheid was about. But it took a longer time, including for people like me, to really understand and grapple with the nature of Israel. So,
yes,
I hope that wasn't too elaborate.
No, I think you're right. And one anecdote I'd just like to relate is when I started this site, I remember walking around Columbia University campus in 06 with a Palestinian friend. And it was late at night, we'd had something to drink, and he suddenly ran out into Broadway and said, he just raised his hand, my goal in life is to end Zionism. And I was like, oh, I was shocked by that. And later I said to this guy, his name was Saif, I said, Saif, hey, can I quote you on my blog? I found that electrifying what you said. I don't know what to think about it, but I found it shocking and electrifying. And he said, no, you can, that will destroy. So just that the degree of secrecy and fear and anxiety around that statement, a very simple declaration of what I think are good prints, was shocking to me then. And now I think it's almost a commonplace that you'll hear people on. Certainly my own publisher has said, just tweeted recently when someone was talking about my goal is to, protect Israel from ever, he tweeted, "My goal is to end Zionism."
Yeah.
And I think that that's a worthy goal in the Jewish community. And I have many friends who share it, and they're not, there's the apprehension and anxiety and fear and excitement and a shock that accompanied that statement 15 years ago for me, and I think for many others, is no longer there. And that's a great thing.
Yeah. And the real question is, what took so long? Right. You know, for a lot of us.
Well, we have something to answer for.
I'm not including myself either.
Yeah, Jeff, you and me, we have to, you know, a little self-flagellation comes in. We deserve it.
That was peace activist Jeff Klein and Mondo Weiss's Phil Weiss discussing shifting opinions of Israeli Zionism within the Jewish community. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, where you can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. You can also stream us live on Sunday evenings at KKRN.org at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved with the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We will talk again next week.